Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Frédéric Lilien. He is the producer and director of the film The Legend of Pale Mail, a wonderful film which has won numerous awards, which opens on New Year's Day at the CCA here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me, Mary Charlotte.
And it's amazing. We can speak to you on Skype from Belgium. It's just great to have you. This is a story about a red-tailed hawk that takes up residence at one of the most expensive and prestigious apartment buildings in Manhattan, 927th Fifth Avenue, facing Central Park. How did you first spot this hawk?
Well, at the time, and that was quite a long time ago, you know, we talk almost 20 years ago, I was working in a hair salon on the Upper East Side. I was the manager of, we had probably like 40 employees. It was quite a big hair salon, and I must say I hated that job. And whenever I could escape, I would, and I would quickly go to Central Park and have my lunch there. And one day he was having his own lunch on a branch right above my head. And I guess that changed my life.
And the lunch he was having was what, a pigeon?
A good old fat New York pigeon, yes.
So these are very large birds of prey that are unusual in places like New York City. And as you describe in this really fascinating film, it affected your own journey when you decided to start filming him. Tell us about that process, how it began and evolved.
Like I said, I think first you need a job that you really hate and that really helps you to kind of ask yourself, what are you doing with your life? And seeing this bird really kind of woke up this childhood dream in me, and I had this naive idea that suddenly I would pick up a camera and become a wildlife filmmaker. And within a year, I would be done with that film. And here we are 20 years later. But I guess in life, sometimes you need to have, follow your instinct and then be lucky. I mean, this story has been quite amazing and written through this hawk all over those 2 decades. And my God, I was so lucky. I mean, he's still alive today.
You know, it's such one of the things that's so fascinating is it's a story not just about a hawk, but the hawk's relationships with its several mates, your relationship with the hawks, and then this whole subculture of people that meet each other through setting up binoculars and telescopes and things to watch this hawk with its mate and eventually its little baby hawks that are hatched there. Tell us about this subculture that arose in Central Park watching Pale Mail, the red-tailed hawk.
Well, I did a first film for Nature PBS. I mean, it took me 6 years to do that one. And that one was more of a classic, I would say, nature documentary, even if at the time there was already something quite new because it was already about people. But nevertheless, it was, we had a lot of natural history in it. And when we went down with that, we thought that I would never film a hawk again in my life. I just had spent 6 years doing that. But then the story got bigger and better. And then we were approached, by different producers to make a feature documentary. And we thought if we do this, we want to tell our own story. And we felt the fascination that people had for this hawk and what happened when this hawk decided to come and live with us, what happened. And it all started on sitting on a bench in Central Park, and somebody would sit next to you and then another person, and the one on your left would be a billionaire living on a building next to Pale Mail. and the one on the other side would be a homeless living on that, literally on that bench. And suddenly all those people got together and by witnessing this beautiful story, I guess a community was created thanks to Pale Male. So it's really how people are affected, I would say, by the beauty of nature.
It's a story also of how loving and cooperative and nature-oriented New Yorkers are, and that's not our usual stereotype of New Yorkers.
Well, I guess it's true. I mean, we know New Yorkers. Yeah, those tough guys. But that's the beauty of it. When they would see this baby and those parents taking care of those chicks, people would stop and sit and spend an hour and then two and three and then come back the next day and come back for weeks without really being able to explain why. But I guess nature is in all of us, wherever we are, wherever we live, and whoever we are.
People were projecting their feelings about their own families onto the birds, their sense of their own fathers or their own hopes and aspirations, and it becomes very emotional. And it fascinated me. I mean, you just couldn't imagine them doing the same things with pigeons. It had to be this magnificent and exotic hawk that allowed them to look into themselves and their own lives in that way.
Yeah, I mean, we know that there's a fascination for birds of prey. I mean, they symbolize, in a way, strength and freedom and beauty. But, I mean, to us, it was interesting to explore that anthropomorphic aspect. Which, of course, in nature film is a big no-no. But here we felt, let's go for it. I mean, let's explore all of that. And in a way, it's true that Pale Male, because he was the first one coming into New York, he really became some sort of a symbol. It was very hard for me to understand, and I'm maybe jumping ahead here in the story, eventually, the nest was removed by the cover board, and I was in Belgium at the time, and my producer called me and said, come over here, took the next plane, and here there were hundreds of people on Fifth Avenue in the middle of winter protesting, asking for the nest to be put back on that building. And even myself, I was having trouble to understand. I mean, there's so many bigger issues in the world. And I started to receive emails from everybody. And this one in particular really helped me to understand what was going on. And this guy was a soldier in Iraq. And he was outraged by what happened. And he was writing to Bloomberg, he was writing to Hillary Clinton, and suddenly it hit me. I mean, this guy is in hell, surviving, trying to survive over there, and he's spending his free time fighting for this nest. And I guess we all need those symbols, those pockets of magic that kind of help us to go on with our daily lives. And I guess that's what Pale Male had achieved. He had become more than a hawk, more than a bird. He had become a symbol.
I have started to question the concept that when we see animals, wild animals, in the way that these people saw the hawk Pale Male, that we're anthropomorphizing them. To some extent, that may be true, but I think also what's happening is people are seeing in them that which is common to all living things. For example, the pair bonding, the providing for their families, the being against all odds, able to survive in such a hostile place. We don't have to anthropomorphize them to feel that that's what happened. That's what happened. That's what is happening.
Yes, no, absolutely. And maybe there's, here we are down below, complex life, with all our mortgage and our work and, you know, all our daily issues. And Pale Male and his mate are just there with the simplicity and the beauty of survival, which is tough, but nevertheless, it's beautiful. It's simple and beautiful. And I've seen so many people sitting on those benches, having their lives touched and transformed. And I kind of scratched the surface. But I had people who were coming out of the hospital who were cancer patients and suddenly saw Pale Male and came back every day and told me years later how much seeing the nest helped them to go through their challenges.
Amazing. Now, do you think the birds were aware of you, of the fact that they had this audience?
Well, it's very hard to say. I mean, definitely, I think that Pale Male knew me and knew the people on the bench because we were there, you know, almost, I would say, on a daily basis. And knowing that after a while, we were not representing a threat. For him or the nest or the chicks. But I think that's the extent of it. You know, that's, it's kind of great that they're totally unaware of the attention that they got all over the years.
Now, when the co-op board of this building, 927 Fifth Avenue, took down the nest without any notice, you know, one moment it was gone, there, next moment it was gone, Pale Male, the red-tailed hawk, and his mate looked at their home that had been essentially, you know, bulldozed or destroyed, whatever you want to call it, and said, "Oh my God, we got no place to live." And they kept looking and saying, "What are we going to do now?" Because the spikes that had been there to prevent birds from landing had made the perfect form to hold the twigs for their nest. These protests were so surprising to this extremely wealthy and exclusive group of people who lived in this building, and admittedly, some of them were on the side of the hawk people, but most of them didn't want the attention focused on the building. They had no idea how huge and how strong this protest would be.
Absolutely. I mean, you kind of have to understand them on the one hand, that there were a lot of attention to that building, and you know, in a way, you must fear for them. Even if the bird watcher, the hawk watcher, really didn't care about the life of those people living in that famous building. But it's true. I mean, they felt, oh, you know, we're going to have a few old ladies, you know, crying in front of the building for a few nests, but it's raining and in a few days it will be all over. They had no idea how much Pale Male and his men had become famous. Of course, the press had a ball with that. You know, I mean, everything, and I asked the press, I said, "Why are you guys here?" And day after day. And they said, "This is the best. This is the perfect story. You have all the contrast. You know, it's a wild animal in the middle of New York City. It's the rich against the poor, you know, it's David against Goliath. It's everything." So it was kind of a piece of candy for the press, and I guess it really helped the cause.
And it was also such great material for your film. I mean, who knew that this film that started with some very shaky moving pictures of this hawk that you could barely see in the frame of your camera. Which I love that this film has such a great sense of humor too. I love that you show all the mistakes that you made along the way. But the arc of this story is, it's as if, you know, it was a gift to this story as a documentary, including the fact that the director of the New York Audubon Society was a poet and suddenly was thrust into the limelight in the cause of saving this bird.
You know, the best Hollywood writer could not come with a better story. And it's all true. And that's all we had to do, is to follow the story. I mean, I remember when, we started to film again and filming the protests and eventually the story was going very well. And we thought, oh, in 3 months, we're done. We're going to have a happy ending. And in 6 months, we have a film. And, it didn't happen that way. And it took another year, and then another, and then another. And it was extremely depressing. Can you imagine the pressure and the stress year after year looking for that ending? And the writer eventually told me, listen, we need to trust the story again. It has been leading us all those years. Just trust the story. And it happened. And it happened in a way that we would have never imagined. And I guess it makes the story much richer. So, it's one of the best recipes to give yourself time. And that's what we did here.
And it's the kind of film that Santa Feans love. We had the Wild Parrots of Telegraph Hill for a long time and other bird films and animal films. And this is one that I think people will love as much as those others, at least. I was thinking as I was watching it about this book. I don't know if you read it, but it was called The World Without Us by Alan Wiseman. And it's about what would happen to all the human structures and natural phenomena in the world if humans were to suddenly vanish. And I was thinking about that when these birds and then their offspring begin to really take up residence in our cities, on our bridges, on the top of our buildings, in these great monuments to human ingenuity and capitalism and so on. And it made me wonder whether we are moving into a mindset of being able to actually really share our habitat.
Well, it's true that, pale man coming to town is a real gift. And now we have, I believe, something like 40 pairs of red tails nesting in the city, in the 5 boroughs. So they really took over the city. It's true we have to learn to live with them, but what a gift, what a present for all of us. So, in a way, he was an ambassador from the wild. He was the first one. But I believe that red tails are doing extremely well all over the country. And we've heard of sightings and nesting in cities. I don't know if you had any in Santa Fe, but over the years I've heard, they're nesting all over the country now, all over the cities.
Frédéric Lélien is the producer and director of the film The Legend of Pale Male, which opens on New Year's Day at the CCA. Thank you so much for being with us and for making this fine film.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the show Stephen Kotler. He is an author. His newest book is called A Small Furry Prayer, Dog Rescue and the Meaning of Life. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So your life in dog rescue started, I guess, when you met the woman who is now your wife. Is that right?
That is right.
And so what happened? What was your first experience of dog rescue?
My first experience of dog rescue was a very good friend of mine introduced me to Joy, and I was immediately smitten. And he knew, he saw it, and kind of pulled me aside afterwards and said, oh, she's an amazing woman. She's a great writer. She's also an author. She's a great, great writer, but she's crazy. And I said, oh, crazy how? He said, well, dog rescue. It's a cult, not a cause. And that was my introduction to dog rescue, was this idea that, I'd been around animal geeks my whole life and people who were passionate about various things, animal-related things, but I knew really little about dog rescue. So my first experience was being told that it was a cult, and I got curious, and it actually, I've got 2 decades of journalism behind me, it made me actually start to dive in and try to figure out what the hell dog rescue actually is, at the same time that I was getting involved with Joy and getting first-hand experience.
What was she doing at the time? You were both living in L.A.
We were both living in L.A. She had been running a no-kill shelter in Mexico for about 6 years, and and that kind of went away, and she had moved back to Los Angeles, kind of a long, torturous move, but she had come back to Los Angeles back about a year, and And that was kind of when we met.
To Los Angeles, where they have, as you write, a 90% kill rate in their shelters.
They do. They do. That I don't know how uncommon that kill rate is in most major cities. It's really, actually, I don't know whether or not you know, the Humane Society, the official numbers by the Humane Society are 6 to 8 million dogs are turned into shelters every year, and about half are euthanized. Those are the official numbers. I have spent years trying to figure out, are they real? How real are they? Every rescuer I've ever spoken to believes they're massively underreporting their data, but I have never found any accurate data above that. But, you know, it's a lot of animals that are getting put into shelters where there's not a lot of space, and the kill rates are high.
You... Both of you moved together to New Mexico, and you actually bought a small farm in Chimayo with the intention of rescuing dogs.
Yeah, sort of. We mostly threw a dart at the map when we picked Chimayo.
Really?
Yeah. We lost our house in Los Angeles. It was sold out from under us, and we had, at that point, an illegal number of dogs. The legal number of dogs you can have in Los Angeles proper is 3, and we had 8 at that point. And our house got sold out from under us about a month and a half after the peak of the housing market, and rental occupancy rates were like 96%. So trying to find a landlord willing to bend those rules, taken Joy, I think, 2 years to find our house in the first place. So there really was nothing else to do. So we did what rational people do under those circumstances. We got really drunk, and we made a long list of like everything we wanted in a place to live.
What was on that list?
Well, it was silly. Well, first of all, Joy has lupus and I have Lyme. So we both needed 300 days of sunshine a year because we need to be able to move our bodies. And autoimmune conditions need heat. We also needed few zoning laws for animals because we had 8 dogs and plans for more. We wanted to scale up our rescue operations. And then it was like everything from a clawfoot bathtub to scientists and artists in the neighborhood. It was really silly. But when we sobered up, we realized that New Mexico was just about the only place we could go. So I jumped in my car and drove out here and, you know, bought a house in 10 seconds, essentially.
And so you ended up being here. And one of the things that I find so interesting about your book, A Small Furry Prayer, is that there's a lot of dog literature online. I mean, if you look up dogs, but a lot of it is about cuteness or about obedience training. And what this story is, it's a human story. It's a human and animal relationship story. It's neuroscience. It's your personal experience. It's dog behavior. It's shamanism. It's basically a lot of the things that I think intelligent dog owners are thinking about and working with all the time, but I've never seen it written down before, especially all together.
Yeah, the only thing I can tell you is I think part of it is accidental, kind of my experience, and part of it is kind of my science geek, science writer background. The accidental part was when I was, long before I actually met Joy, when I was living in Los Angeles, I had a dog named Ahab, and I realized that just in trying to take care of Ahab, I was faced with all kinds of actual hardcore moral and ethical questions that I had never encountered before in my life. And they were actual real philosophical questions that I realized that everybody who, you know, owns a dog or an animal of any kind has that relationship is going to face. You know, how do you privilege your needs versus their needs? All those kinds of things. And I was pretty startled. I was, you know, 35 years old around the time I got a dog, maybe a little younger. And I turned a corner and suddenly there was a whole raft of ethical questions I had never had to deal with before. And it really got me thinking that there was a heavy kind of philosophical component to, you know, human-animal relations that I hadn't really paid attention to before. That was the first part. The second part was my friend had told me that animal rescue is a cult. So I started trying to figure out, well, what is it like? What are the actual numbers? How big is this movement? And one of the things I quickly figured out is that animal rescue is a massive movement, right? There are 78 million dogs in America. 20 to 25% of them have been rescued. So 20 million Americans have taken part in a dog rescue. And if you look at the full numbers, there are 15,000 independent shelters like the one Joy and I are running. 150 of them have budgets of $1 million. But the big number and the startling number and what really caught me was, all told, Americans spend $2.5 billion a year on animal sheltering and advocacy. That's a massive amount of money, and nobody knows why. And this is the puzzle I was getting to. Altruism has been a, you know, topic debate going all the way back to the beginning of religion, but starting, you know, roughly in the 1970s, Richard Dawkins kind of settled the debate with the publication of The Selfish Gene, and we've discovered that altruism, it's not really actually altruism, it's really selfishness in disguise, in that we help those who help us pass along our genes. So that's the general idea. Here's the problem. Cross-species altruism, which is helping an animal, helping a dog, doesn't matter what I do for a dog, none of it is going to help me pass along my genes. So we've got this giant mystery at the heart of dog rescue. We've got Americans spending $2.5 billion a year, you know, 20 million Americans partaking in animal rescue, and nobody knows why. And as a science geek, you know, here's this giant big question that nobody understands. And on top of it, when you get into the rescue world, you know, I think my wife is an exceptional woman, but I don't think she's any more exceptional than other rescuers. And she's putting 8 to 10 hard, hard hours into the dogs every day. And that's kind of standard behavior for the rescue community. So it's not just like a little bit of altruism. She's giving the whole of her life to these animals, and a whole lot of other people are as well, I guess, and myself included these days. And nobody can explain it. So, you know, ethical concerns, this weird scientific puzzle, these were the kinds of things that they brought me into the book, and those were some of the things I first started trying to answer. I was trying to write, nobody had ever written a book that explained the animal rescue movement for people outside of the movement. There have been a couple self-published, I'm an animal rescuer and this is, you know, how you do it, there's some how-to stuff, but there's nothing that kind of like surveys the movement like a reporter would and just says, well, let's take a look at it. How big is it? What's going on? Why is it happening? What's at the core of it? And those were the questions I started out trying to answer in Small Furry Prayer.
We're talking to Stephen Cutler. You make no bones about the fact that you're not only observing it, but you're very much a part of it. And you know, have a wife, and the two of you sleep with any number of chihuahuas and other animals under your covers or in the crook of your neck, and are dealing with some very tough stuff. I mean, there's a passage which I'm hoping maybe you'd want to read in a little while, which involves a pretty rough situation with the dog. But the thing about it, and I can see why people call it either a cult or a spiritual practice, is no matter how many dogs you rescue, it's a drop in the bucket. You're not going to save all dogs. And yet you keep doing it, almost as if it were a practice, just a spiritual practice, a way of giving.
I think there's two answers. There's actually two answers. One is a question that I get asked very frequently, which is what you just said. How can you kind of continue the Sisyphean, you know, push the rock uphill effort without, you know, falling into abject despondency, which a lot of rescuers ask me, and a lot of rescuers do fall into despondency, and I actually come at it from a totally different angle. I look at it this way. 150 years ago, there wasn't even a law in this country protecting an animal. It's 150 years later, 20 million Americans helping out dogs. Doesn't count, like, I mean, the American rescue movement goes, you know, from eagles through crayfish at this point. I mean, it's huge, it's sweeping, it's all animals, it's $2.5 billion a year. You've got laws now in Europe that protect, for example, in Spain, you have great apes have the same rights as all humans. In Switzerland, there's a law that
The same rights?
Yeah.
Where they vote?
Great apes. They don't have voting rights, but they are afforded the exact same rights in terms of you can't torture them, you can't injure them, you can't.
Right.
They're protected in that way, with the same way humans are. Switzerland, there's a law in the book, and God knows what this means, but it protects the dignity of all organisms. Who the hell knows what that means, right?
You know, maybe I draw the line at cockroaches. I'm sorry,
but what it shows me is that there's a sweeping change, you know. And I think whatever you want to say about history being cyclical, we as a species tend to move towards freedom. People are freer today across the board than they ever have been before. And obviously we have a very long way to go, but I think animals are what's next. And I think more and more people are kind of coming to those conclusions, and we're moving in that direction, and I'm thrilled by what's going on. So people might want to look at it as pushing the rock uphill. I'm looking at it as, well, this is a giant collaborative community that's really working towards some neat goals, and that's fun. And to me, that's kind of the response. The other side of it is something that we spoke about briefly earlier, which is you wouldn't know it unless you actually get to live with a pack of dogs, but you know, on one side, you look at all the suffering and how hard it is and blah, blah, blah. The other side is I get to live with a pack of dogs, and I get to live in a slightly alternative universe than most people get to live in, and it's super neat and super fulfilling and super interesting, and I keep learning, and it really does actually add a great deal to my life. I think when people look at it, they go, oh, my God, you live with 20 dogs. How that's got to, you know, it's going to interrupt everything you do. Well, yeah, sure it is. But it's also going to open up a whole ton of doors that nobody else gets to walk through unless you live with a pack of dogs. And those doors are really interesting.
One of the things that you talk about that's interesting is going from having a pet to having a pack. I went through the same thing. I had my little dog, Honey, and suddenly I had two dogs and three dogs and occasionally four. And it's a different dynamic. But one of the things you realize is that while they certainly are domesticated and they behave differently than the wolves from whom they are descended, on some level, you're living with these little wild animals whom you don't know. You're sharing a house with them. You have agreements with them. You have friendships and relationships with them, but you don't know them.
I think there's two points in your statement that are both really smart. The first is one of the things you see, and you've probably seen it a bit with just three dogs, four dogs, but you definitely see it when you have, you know, more than 20, is that, first of all, we now know, and we've known probably since the 70s, because thanks to the work of a neuroscientist named Jaak Panksepp, that animals have the exact same emotions as we do. They've got the same seven core emotions, they've got the same affective emotions, social emotions, and this gives them personalities that are kind of as rich as human personality. Most people don't notice because personality is something that reveals itself through comparison. When you have a pack of dogs, you can separate out breed-specific from behavior, from canine behavior, and you can actually say, oh, this is what is personality, and you start to realize that the line kind of between human and dog is a lot thinner than most people expect, and most of the, like, quirky, funny things you see in humans, you also see in dogs. One of the stories that I tell a lot is, we see a lot of homosexual behavior in our pack, which is not surprising. Homosexual behavior shows up in over 400 species of animals, but it gets really specific. We've got a tiny little hunchback chihuahua named Damien who is extremely picky about his clothes. Chihuahuas need sweaters in the mountains in the winter, right, to stay warm. Damien's really, really picky about his clothes, and when he finds a sweater to his liking, we are treated to the canine equivalent of a drag show. Literally. And whatever you feel about a drag show, like it, don't like it, you would think it's a human-specific behavior. It's not something you would describe to animals. But no, sure enough, it shows up. And those are the kinds of things that start to show up, and they start to make you kind of, not that you think less of humans, but you start to see that a lot of our behaviors actually, you know, are still animal behaviors. You know, we gussy them up with some language and whatnot, but there's not that big of a difference. And there's a lineage there.
I think this idea that human beings are the crown of creation and that we're fundamentally different, I mean, I grew up being taught that we're not animals at all, that we are human beings and that we're different from animals. And I remember studying evolution in high school and going home and having some conversations about this. And I said, but we all have eyes and noses and lungs and these are the conversations. I mean, but this is, you know, how long ago was that? Not very long ago. I think in many circles, we've moved on since then. But what's happening, I think, in science, and that your book shows in lots of beautiful and different ways, is that all the ways in which we thought we were fundamentally different from other species, those lines are continually being blurred by science, by research.
You know, it's funny about that. There's a general kind of rule in science. Scientists know that, as a general rule, science is directionally accurate, but it's not always factually accurate, or it's factually accurate within a given set of what would be called boundary conditions or constraints. For whatever reason, we have this idea that humans and animals are different and that, you know, these categories are set in stone, but there's a long list, as you just pointed out: laughter, consciousness, emotion, homosexual behavior, empathetic behavior, altruistic behavior, spiritual experience. It goes fashion. It goes on and on and on.
Tools.
Tool use. These were all supposed to be human-only categories. It's gotten to the point that one of the world's leading experts on the differences between humans and animals is a guy named Richard Granger. He's at Dartmouth. He runs the Brain Engineering Lab. He spent a couple of decades trying to find what are the differences in the brain between humans and animals. And at this point, he's found maybe 10, and they're all tiny, 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 tiny microscopic differences that actually can't account for behavior or anything we might put in the category of human specialness. So on one hand, we don't actually know why humans are special, but every time we try to put a point to something and say this is the reason, within a couple of years that reason goes by the wayside. So it, you know, it's an ongoing and very, very interesting puzzle. But, you know, we are definitely not as special as we once were.
The one thing we do seem to do, and we talked with this about this with Jane Goodall once, is long-term planning.
It is true, but that is... and I agree with her. I mean, I agree that we don't see it, but we also have no idea what would an animal long-term plan for? And, I mean, on a certain level, migration, which we see every year in animals, is a long-term plan. I'm going to fly south for 3 months to get someplace so I can, you know, procreate for a species that only lives, you know, a fixed amount of time, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, whatever. Migration is a long-term plan. So, we write it off. We call it instinct, right? Oh, this isn't a long-term planning. It's instinct. But is it really? Are we sure? How do we know?
Well, and how much of what we do that we think is rational thought is in fact instinct?
That is another question as well. It's a good one.
Another thing that we take as our purview is culture, but one of the things that I've noticed, partially by having my own little dog pack and partially by seeing how differently dogs behave in different countries, is animals have their own cultures and their real cultural differences.
I think that's true. One of the things I talk about in the book is kind of very early on, we had a very persnickety, kind of mean-spirited bull terrier named Otis. And we had a miniature chihuahua named Gidget. And one day, I was on the couch. I was actually buried under dogs because it was thunderstorming out, and the dogs are all scared of thunder, and my wife was in town. And Gidget is also terrified of thunder, and Otis was kind of sleeping by my feet. And I couldn't move because, you know, I was weighed under by dogs at this point, but it started thundering, and Gidget made a mad dash for Otis. And normally, if, you know, a dog even gets into Otis's line of sight, he'll attack. And Otis was sleeping at the time, so Gidget managed to, like, run up on his back and try to dive under his arm for protection from the thunder. And Otis's immediate reaction was he looked like, you know, Goofy when he gets hit by the 2x4, like his eyebrows shot up to the ceiling. But in the next moment, I saw what I would call deductive logic in a dog. Otis kind of realized that if Gidget's on his back, well, she has to be crazy. And if she was, she's actually a brain-damaged dog. And if she was crazy, then maybe the normal rules don't apply. And Otis snorted once and went back to sleep, leaving Gidget on her back. Now, that's kind of amazing, empathetic, whatsoever. But within a week, Gidget was allowed to run up and sleep on any of the dogs in our pack. That it transmitted through the pack. Now, Otis died about 4 or 5 months after this story, and it's many, many generations of dogs who have moved through our sanctuary since then, and Gidget still gets a pass with all the dogs. So we saw cultural transmissions spread through the pack, and now we have it through multiple generations of non-related animals. So that's an actual example of culture. And I don't think, by the way, I don't think there's anything special going on with our dogs. I think the key point is most of the research we have on dogs comes from one of two places. It comes from either studies run in labs, which are totally unnatural conditions, or from surveys of pet owners. Unfortunately, dogs evolved to live large packs of dogs, small groups of humans. There are 78 million dogs in America owned by roughly 69, 70 million families. Most people have one dog. So they're not going to see this kind of behavior. They're not creating conditions where you could even observe this kind of behavior. I don't think there's anything special going on with us seeing cultural transmission in our dogs. I just think we happen to live with a large pack of dogs, so the situation can exist.
We're talking to Stephen Cutler. His book is called A Small Furry Prayer, Dog Rescue and the Meaning of Life. There was a section in your book that I found fascinating that I thought might make a good reading right now about a terrier named Chow.
Chow was a crazy, crazy dog. She had basically everything you could possibly imagine wrong with her, including severe anger issues. She showed up. She was one of the fattest dogs I've ever seen. I couldn't like actually believe how fat she was. She bit everything, anybody who came close. Dogs, humans. She was blind. She was mostly deaf. She was food obsessed. Her heart was failing. Most of her other organs were not far behind. She had been abused at a van. Everything was wrong with this dog.
And I have to say, when I was reading that section of the book, I thought, how can they have taken her in? I mean, that's where the dog rescue thing gets really fascinating. Like, you took this dog in. You were ready to love this dog.
Well, if you only got a couple of dogs, you want your dogs cute and cuddly, and you want them as some, like, you know, there's a part of us that, you know, just like when you go to the store to buy a jacket, you want a jacket that kind of speaks to you, whatever. People have that relationship with dogs. They want a dog that kind of, oh, it's a reflection of my personality or whatever it is. But when you are taking in dozens of dogs and you can drop those requirements, my dogs are not an expression of myself at all. There's no kind of ego relationship to it. Then these hospice cases and these kind of other cases become really interesting to live with. And they're, you know, as you'll see in the section that I'm going to read, when you actually do have a success on the flip side, you spoke earlier about how, you know, there's a cross-species friendship in and of itself is amazing. The thing that's amazing about rescue, and to me, one of the most amazing things is when you have to earn that friendship, when it's not just like I got this puppy and he loved me immediately because he was a puppy, and it becomes, wow, this dog hates human beings and takes like 3 months for me to earn its trust. And when that happens, when you have to earn the friendship, you start to realize, first of all, how amazing the fact that we have this cross-species friendship in the first place. It's astounding. But, you know, the comparison I always use is when a dog like Gidget, kind of the mini chihuahua is just talking about, runs up on my chest and kind of dances around or whatever. That's the rough equivalent of me running up on the chest of a small dinosaur.
Right.
You know, or an elephant or a giraffe. That is nothing I would do pretty, you know what I mean? I would think long and hard before I did that. And our dogs do it all the time. That's astounding. The fact that it just happens is astounding. And we don't notice it because we take them for granted in this way. But with rescue animals, you got to work for it. And so the relationship becomes something that you treasure because you actually get to see it for what it is.
And so back to this dog, Chow. This is a real example.
This is a real example.
Go ahead and read the passage. So you've got this blind, deaf, failing, angry dog.
Yeah, the thing you need to know is I'm sitting on my back porch. All of our dogs are out there at the time, and Chow is out there, and she has one of the hardest things. This is the last background story, and this is why it happened. I'd been growing really frustrated because this was still early on in our experience, and I hadn't realized that, like, we have dogs I can't pet. Every dog I've ever been around, I can pet. But we've got dogs who are feral or wild or aggressive or whatever, and we can't actually touch them. Chow is one of those cases. All right. Rescue can be a very intuitive process. And by intuitive, I mean that one afternoon, possibly because some tequila was involved, my better plan was screw it. I just reached down and picked Chow up. It was like trying to cuddle a tornado. Spinning, shaking, snarling, biting, barking. I kept her at arm's length with my elbows locked and fingers firm until that first wave of panic subsided. In those moments of exhausted reprieve before the next round, I sat down in a chair and locked her waist between my legs. This was perhaps not the best maneuver. I had inadvertently exposed my genitals to her claws and my eyes to her teeth. Chow was already availing herself of the first target and working her way towards the second. I was all set to hurl her across the porch when intuition struck again, and I shoved my perfectly healthy hand into her vigorously snapping maw. I guess that's why they call it intuition. Chow's mouth turned out to be small enough that with my fist wedged inside, she couldn't apply nearly as much pressure. She chomped and chomped, and after about 10 minutes, the feeding frenzy vanished, suddenly replaced by profound befuddlement. Chow had finally noticed that my other hand had been stroking her back the whole while. This may have been the first time in her life that she'd felt affection, and where was it coming from? She glanced over her right shoulder, then looked left. Pretty soon she was whipping her head back and forth like a speed freak at a tennis match. It was fear of neck snapping that finally made me let her go. Then she leaped off my lap and shot across the porch, but froze at the edge. One paw lifted, the other legs bent. Whatever that next move, Chow never made it. Instead, she waddled back over, plopped down at my feet, and began licking my toes. And in dog rescue, this is what a good day looks like.
Amazing. We're talking to Stephen Cutler. Now, that's a moment where you essentially broke through to a dog's emotional side, let it know that it was loved, and from then on, the dog's behavior was different.
It was radically different. Well, that was actually her breakthrough with humans. Her breakthrough with other dogs took a while, but we actually got that as well. And this was one of those cases where she actually had the breakthrough occurred in one moment, and she was fundamentally altered. Sometimes, you know, it takes a stack of those moments, five or six of them. It really depends on the level of the emotional response you can get, how many neurochemicals you can get flowing through the dog, essentially, to change the behavior. Sometimes it's more than that, but the intuition is interesting. I mean, you know, nothing in my life experience would ever say the best way to handle a dog is to shove my hand into its mouth, but that's what worked in that particular case.
And speaking of neurochemistry, there's something else that you write about called helper's high, and that is when you have a really profound experience of helping an animal. It also can happen helping other human beings. And it turns out that high that people get is much greater than even extreme athletes get from doing their sport.
Yeah, this is actually a really interesting thing. And in my earlier book, In West of Jesus, I had really looked long and hard at the kind of the relationship between what psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi calls a flow state, or Abraham Maslow called peak experiences, with what's quote-unquote mystical experiences, and I looked at how the neurochemistry of a flow state was almost the exact same as the neurochemistry of a mystical experience, and the same things were going on in the brain. Flow states show up very frequently during sports, as you just mentioned. They show up everywhere from, you know, Larry Bird wrote about them in his autobiography in basketball. They show up in extreme sports, skiing, rock climbing, all that kind of stuff. Turns out they show up in altruism all the time. And helper's high was a term that was coined by John Lukes, who runs Big Brother, Big Sister. And he started looking at this high back in the 90s. And what he figured out very quickly is, unlike normal flow states, which can last an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours tops, and show up pretty rarely, helper's high showed up, and I'm going to get these numbers a little wrong, but they're ballpark close, in like 80 to 85% of his study group got helper's high, and a lot of them reported it lasted for days, which is significantly longer than the average flow state. So the interesting thing about altruism is not so much that, not just that it produces flow states, which in and of itself is really interesting, but the fact that they last so long and they show up so frequently, it's really another scientific puzzle.
So you are now in Chimayo, and your dog sanctuary is called Rancho de Chihuahua. What are you actually doing now? Are you getting the rescued dogs available for adoption, doing hospice, a little bit of both?
We do four things. We do hospice care for older dogs because we believe how a dog dies matters. We do long-term rehab for dogs with severe physical and emotional problems, dogs that need 1 to 2 to 3 years worth of work before they'll be eligible for adoption, if it ever. We do some kind of general fostering work where we work with shelters both here in New Mexico and a couple shelters in Los Angeles. And then we run a program called Cuddle Buddies, where we work with people with very severe handicaps, people who cannot, either because of their handicaps or their living situations or both, actually have a dog as a companion. So we essentially lend them one, and we bring the dog to them once a week so they can actually hang out with a dog, which, if you know anything about the relationship between dogs and health, dogs really, really boost our immune system for a lot of different reasons.
They keep us from having heart disease and help us recover when we have heart attacks and those kinds of things.
Everything,
incredible.
Everything from heart attacks through depression. As a matter of fact, one of the craziest things about dogs is, when we talk about humans' co-evolution with dogs, this is a great example of how powerful it is. The best medicine on the market for anxiety, Prozac, Zoloft, the like, they take about a month to work and they don't work in everybody.
But you and they have nasty side effects.
You can pet a dog for 4 to 24 minutes and then measure cortisol levels in the bloodstream. Cortisol is a stress hormone, and petting a dog for 4 to 24 minutes will drop cortisol levels lower than the very best antidepressants on the market. And it works in everybody regardless of your body's chemistry.
Extraordinary. Now, I have to say that sleeping with dogs, which is something that a lot of people think is weird, is actually something that we have been doing for, what, tens of thousands of years, millions of years?
The actual how long humans and dogs have been co-evolving is an ongoing question. The old answer used to be 14,000 years, and that was based on what are called simultaneous burials. They found humans and dogs buried together in the same gravesite. We've since developed DNA dating techniques, and there's an argument, but the number is somewhere between 50 and 135,000 years. But to your point, if we've been evolving with dogs, co-evolving with dogs for 135,000 years, we've been with dogs for longer than we've actually been human in some cases. So it's a great, big, long period of time. And I think, you know, one of the very first things that happened, why did we co-evolve with dogs? Well, why was it so mutually beneficial? There's a lot of arguments, but one of the things is they taught us how to hunt, and they acted as our alarm systems, right? We brought them into the campsites. They lived with us. They liked our garbage, which is why they were attracted to us. They wanted our refuge. But we wanted them as security alarms. So once you kind of open up to that and start sleeping with dogs, there's a whole lot of kind of DNA code in you that says, feel safe, you have a dog around you. And once you open to that, once it's gone, if you know have dogs and then don't have dogs or travel or go on vacation or whatever, sleep without your dogs, it's really like there's a part of you missing. It's like you've been sleeping with a baseball bat under the bed and suddenly it's gone and you feel naked.
I know, believe me. I mean, and the three-dog night is actually a term that's real.
It's a real term. Three dog night was a night so cold you need three dogs in the bed to stay warm, which was one of the other things that we got from dogs very early on, is they became our hot water bottles, basically, and kept us warm at night.
Well, there's a lot more to talk about, but we're just about out of time. Stephen Cutler is the author of the new book, A Small Furry Prayer, Dog Rescue and the Meaning of Life. It's wonderful to have you on the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thanks to Sean Conlon for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.